Session number 19531, Reel 4.
Just ask you what support you did think they were getting in your area in Negros and Belem.
Well, I think they were getting the same support that they were getting all over the country, actually, from the Chinese rural population. We're talking about a Chinese insurgency, basically, communist insurgency. And it's the Chinese rural population they depended on for supplies, for food and drink and information, I suppose, as well. And in those days, that was before the big resettlement operations were started, which were designed to control the rural population in such a way they couldn't provide this support. But at that time, it was obvious that that was what was happening, because, after all, they were terrorists, and a Chinese paddy farmer is going to help them if the alternative is to be beaten to death, which was what happened. So they used terror to get what they wanted. And it wasn't, as I said, until we had the resettlement programs, which I carried out, one in Cameron Highlands, for example, which collected the rural population in protected villages and only allowed them out with limited amounts of food and drink, that it was we were able to counter that particular problem.
How did you carry it out, that resettlement program in the Cameron Highlands?
Well, it was, for the first thing, Cameron Highlands is a series of mountain valleys. It's in the central range running down the center of Malaya. And it consists of a vast number of river valleys in between these mountains, which were settled by Chinese farmers during the Japanese occupation. They'd come away from the cities and taken refuge in the country. And so there was an enormous scatter of Chinese farmers, who were mainly vegetable farmers, in these various mountain valleys, who had first to be located and categorized, really, and listed. And we had to know where they were. And the first stage was quite an intensive operation of identifying where all these farmers were, what they did, and how many of the family, and so on and so forth. And the next thing was to try and identify concentration areas which were located sufficiently conveniently from which a number of these farming areas could be serviced. And then the third stage was to deliver legal documents under the emergency regulations requiring them to move as directed. And the fourth stage was to bring them into these concentration areas and give them materials from which they were able to build houses, timber and attap and all the rest of it. Corrugated iron and so on. And the government, in which I was really the representative, I suppose, my staff were concerned with making sure there were proper sanitary arrangements, there was water, there were latrines, and there were communications. So it was quite an interesting and complicated job, and it meant, of course, ending up with a number of protected villages with guards who were Malay police to start with. So not a very easy situation. A lot of Chinese herded into these villages, surrounded by Malays with whom there was a good deal of hostility anyway. So it gave rise to some difficulty, some of which was dissipated by enlisting Chinese home guards. Who take over this task, and they were all enlisted from the Kuomintang as opposed to the communist sector, so they were motivated to protect these people against the communists. And, but there were difficult times. I mean, the communists would arrive around on these protected villages at night and they'd fire rifles or machine guns or throw bombs over the wire. And often there was a sort of front line mentality, which had to be dealt with. And we had a cadre of police, of European police lieutenants, so mainly ex-Palestine police, brought out to strengthen the police force. And by and large, they were the chaps who had to take command of these protected villages. But after
how did they perform?
I think pretty well. Pretty well, yes. Anyway, that was achieved. And we had a number of successes, but some failures. For example, one of the major villages, which we called Dikongsi at the time, while they still had their Malay guards there, the Malay guard on the gate challenged one of the Chinese going out, and he ran, and the guard shot him, killed him, and he was found to have far more than the allowed amount of food upon him. He was obviously getting a supply of something in the jungle, and everybody was very pleased about that, and the policeman got a reward of $100 or something, and it was great. Quite interesting, several days later, I was at quite clear, there's an enormous amount of firing going on, and I rushed along there, my Land Rover, and it turned out that the communists had set an ambush outside this village and had lured a number of the police guards down this path, by pretending that they got something that they shouldn't have. And they managed to shoot, I think, four or five of these policemen. I arrived, they were still there in the blood, but the comets had taken off, of course. But it was a kind of revenge for what had been carried out a little while before. That was quite an effective revenge, I must say. But, anyway, that was the sort of thing that these incidents lessened, and as I'm sure you know, by and large, the resettlement program was a success. It did what it was supposed to do. It denied the terrorists sources of supply, and it meant they had to come out into the open to more and more to areas where the military and the police could get at them.
So which years were you in Cameron Highlands?
1951.
What was the attitude of the Chinese and others who were resettled?
Quite good, actually. They're fatalists to some extent. They reckon that okay, well, this is what's going to happen. We better make the best of it. I think they didn't react in any. See, one of the things about the Chinese rural population in Malaysia is they had no secure title to their land. The land was held by the government. The Malays were given special land tenure, but the Chinese, at that time, were never given more than what was called a temporary occupation license. So they could theoretically be turfed out any time the government wanted to. So I think that was a kind of hold over the Japanese, the Chinese farmers that we had, which they recognized, and they buckled down to it. On the other hand, we did a lot for them. I mean, I was very much into the sort of hearts and minds business, which you had to try and establish in these situations. And I did quite a lot for the vegetable farmers in, for example, trying to loosen the hold of the moneylenders and the crops, the seed merchants and the fertilizer merchants over the farmer, because as you probably know, in any oriental rural situation, India very much the same, the peasant is dependent on credit for his means of production. And that was very much the case in Cameron Highlands until I formed a cooperative of farmers, and we got them trucks of their own, and we opened a shop down in the Kuala Lumpur market, which got a lot of publicity, and suddenly they felt there was a means where they could live and thrive without being slaves to the moneylenders all the time.
Were the moneylenders Chinese?
Oh, yes.
So were you happy doing this work?
Yes, marvelous. Best time of my life. Exciting, constructive, innovative, marvelous responsibility. I was a district officer, I was a collector of land revenue, I was a magistrate, I was chairman of the town boards of the various towns. I was even registrar of Christian marriages. So that's the sort of thing that one would never have again in one's life. You know? It's a really sort of almost Sanders of the River, but far more sophisticated, dealing with a far more sophisticated population.
And were the enemy strong in Cameron Highlands?
Yes, Cameron Highlands, interesting enough, is a sort of a rest area for all sides. I mean, it's a hill station, basically, and it was developed as a hill station for the Europeans before the war. But as the war, as I mentioned, during the war, it became an enormous agricultural area. But it was still 5,000 feet up, nice and cool. And the terrorists used to go there for recuperation as well. It was also the crossing point of tracks between the East Coast and the West Coast. And so I don't know whether you're familiar with the accounts of those days, the jungle is neutral and that sort of thing, but it was always a very heavily used area by the Chinese guerrillas at that time, and still in my day as well.
And of course, there was a famous assassination there, was there not? A famous assassination.
Oh, the Gurney assassination, yes. Well, that happened in 1950, and that was in Fraser's Hill. That was a hill station further down the range. Yes, that was a considerable achievement on their part.
Were you there then?
I was in Cameron's then. I wasn't in Fraser's Hill. But I remember driving back into Cameron High, into Tanarata, which is our chief town there, and the postmaster leaping out of his post office beside the road and say, waving his arms, said he was an Indian. Sir Gurney has been killed, he said. Sir Gurney. It's quite an actual achievement on the part of the terrorists. You know, governor and high commissioner, top government guy.
So it wasn't in your area of responsibility?
Although we did have, we were very conscious of the dangers of the roads up into the mountains, and we used to have armoured convoys going up to the Cameron Highlands, for example. And if you were wise, I used to go in front of the convoy rather than in it, because I thought the convoy was a target. If something happened to me, they'd come along and sweep me up.
And where were you posted to after Cameron Highlands?
Well, then I went on leave at my first tour, 4 years, quite a long time. Those days it wasn't annual leave by air or anything you know, like that. So we went home on leave. I was married, had kids by then. And came back to Malaya 6 months later, 6 months leave. And guess what? Posted back to the Treasury. Well, that was annoying. But anyway, it was in a way it was a mixed blessing because I was still quite a junior officer, but I was what they call a class 5 officer, and I came back into a class 3 job. And then I was asked to act in a very senior job, class 1B, controller of finance and supply for this whole government. So, you know, it was quite an interesting time and rewarding in a way. It sort of, translated to a completely different level of responsibility. And in a way, when I decided to leave the colonial service, which I did in 55, because independence was coming sometime, but nobody knew when. And I was sort of sitting around waiting for a sort of chopper to fall or for marching orders to be received, I felt was not a good idea. I was 30, and I had a family, and I thought I'd better go out and do something else. So when I did and came back to this country and went into industry, my experience in the Treasury and the various references I had from it were quite useful, as it happened. Far more useful than having been a district officer.
What was the financial situation of the colony?
Well, it was living on a grant in aid from the British government because of the enormous expenses of the emergency. So it was very much the revenues of the colony, of course, were quite high. I mean, tin and rubber were big producers of money, but the gap between that and the cost of 100,000 police and 50,000 soldiers, all that sort, had to be bridged from the British government.
Was there any danger in KL?
No.
You feel completely secure?
Yes.
Why didn't they have an urban presence?
I think that it was too dangerous for them. I think the police were strong in the cities. The CID and the special branch were effective, I think. And the concentration of population, it would have been easy enough to loose off bombs like the IRA, but they didn't think it was a good idea. They didn't want to lose the support of the local population by doing that.